the clock is set just right. Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear three other guys. KC2WGB, his name is John. He handles the mailbag as well as monitoring the EchoLink. So people who are trying to get to us by way of EchoLink, in the past we sometimes didn't leave enough pause so the person wasn't able to get in. By way of that website, John will now know about that and will inform us that somebody is trying to say some words to us. You'll also be hearing later on Paul, WS2N, who tells us the latest on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. And along the way, from time to time, we hear the so-called brief answers by Hal, K6DPZ, who has a lot of experience with an awful lot of radio hardware. The main mission of the TechNet is education. The people who gather here each Sunday night gather because they're curious. They're curious about radio equipment, how it works, how to make it work better, what way to set up antennas and transmission lines, transmitters and receivers and towers, and what kind of propagation is available, what kind of modes of operation are available, what protocols. There are probably 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26. Arguably, this is one of the most educational hobbies we know of. And so, if there's anything about the particular kinds of ham radio you're practicing before you give up this very educational hobby, try one of the other 25 kinds. We have a very loose menu schedule during the first approximately 1 hour. We take general questions and answers from people who sign in who do have a question or comment. That's followed by the mailbag section by John, and then that's followed by Paul with the NASA report. A person who signs into the TechNet does so because he does have a question or a comment. You need not sign in because you're listening. Let me drop. This is TechNet number 1558 of the series that began in September of 1982. Or more than 32 and a half years ago. The TechNet's been around a while. By now, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed to us. We don't need great big long lists of people signing in to say that they're listening. So please sign in if you do have a question or a comment. And that's what we're going to take in right now. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in might sound like this. W-A-2-P-J-F. Veto and yes. That would be a sign-in. So give me your sign-ins right now. K2RIW listening. Okay. If there's no one to sign in, we'll close down the net and see you guys next week.
All right. How about KC2SHO?
KC2SHO. And you didn't give us your name, sir.
This is Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Hotel Oscar John, and Mount Laurel, New Jersey.
KD2CMQ, Neil, yes.
WS2N, Paul with us, Space Report. Hello, John, Dick, everybody else.
Okay, so far we've got John, Neil, Paul. Let me show I got the call letters correct, Neil. Is it Kilo Delta 2? Charlie, Mike, Quebec, go ahead.
It is.
Okay, we got you right. Anyone else to sign in, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Six units.
Yeah, when you take a look at QSZ.com and you look up John, KC2SHO, you'll see some very nice pictures of a shack. And I think he's going to take up this hobby. So you're number one on the runway tonight, John. And we got lots of time, so talk about anything you'd like. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Still have a lot of time here. I've got a guest and hanging out outside with the family. But I didn't get to check in last week. And I've been meaning to look up the archive and listen to last week, but I haven't found time for that either, so I wasn't sure what ever became of the conversation I started about the standing up for standing waves video that that I proposed some people from the group look up and watch and maybe comment on. So wondering if there was any comment on that last week, and if not, if there's any comment now. K2RIW,
KC2SHO. Delay, and the four beeps is shown as only one single beep. And I wonder if it was 2 weeks ago that you signed in, John, as opposed to last week. I'm looking back in my list here. And so, standing wave ratio is something that's always appropriate to talk about. Among the guys who have been working with radio equipment for a whole lot of years, I think rarely will you find more than about half of them have a good understanding of what standing wave ratio is, what is a reverse voltage transfer ratio, S11, which is the parameter that's measured on a vector network analyzer, which is the raw ingredients. Reverse power ratio, reverse voltage ratio, that's the raw ingredients of what standing wave ratio really is. And so, As I told you guys, one of my puzzles that I've given quite a few RF engineers is that at the end of your 50-ohm coax cable, you've got a shielded box. Inside, you've got a variable capacitor, and you're operating at, say, 100 megahertz, and you've carefully adjusted that capacitor so that it has exactly 50 ohms of capacitor reactance. You've got a 50-ohm cable terminated with a 50-ohm capacitor reactance, nearly ideal air variable capacitor. Under those circumstances, what is the standing wave ratio? And more than half of the electronic engineers will say it's 1-to-1. It's 50 ohms load on a 50 ohm transmission line. And they've forgotten about the fact that the proper load for a 50 ohm transmission line is a 50 ohm resistor. Any amount of inductance, any amount of capacitance is going to give you some predictable amount of standing wave ratio. And any mismatch of the resistive component, if it's a 50 ohm coaxial cable, so-called surge impedance, characteristic impedance, then the resistive component has got to be 50.0 ohms. If it's a little bit higher, a little bit lower, you'll get a predictable amount of standing wave ratio from it. But any amount of reactance, even if the resistor is perfect, any amount of reactance along with that resistor is going to give you a predictable amount of standing wave ratio. And you could say that the standing wave ratio builds up a little bit faster because of the capacitive or inductive reactance than it does from a mismatch of the resistance. The reactance is almost more critical. When you look at
NY2H.
Okay, looks like Lou is joining us. When it comes to looking at the Brown and Woodward curves, in other words, these are the set of curves where Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, somewhere around 1945, spent close to a man year of their life choosing every possible reasonable diameter, every possible reasonable length of a monopole, in other words, a vertical ground plane antenna, a very large sheet of metal with, say, a quarter wave radiator in the middle of it, of various lengths and various diameters, and they very carefully plotted what is the resistive component of impedance, and on a separate graph, what is the reactive component. And when you study those graphs, you realize that the slope on the reactive graph is about 5 times higher than the slope on the resistive graph. In other words, any amount of reactance, 50 ohms of reactance, is considerably worse than an error of the 50 ohm resistor. So Lou, I wonder what you want to add to this. I wonder if you had a chance to look at that the video that John is telling us about. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, K2RIW on the TechNet NY2H. I did see the video, and he had a slot line, and he had various little gimmicks. He had he could slide along something with a light on that would detect voltage, so the light intensity proportional voltage. And he had another one that could detect current. So he could go up and down the line and show you in the various configurations, the various SWRs, exactly the distribution of currents and voltages.
Yeah, your audio is a little bit bassy, Lou. The highs are a little bit lacking. It's got good, clean audio, but just that it's quite bassy sounding. If there was a equalizer network, and you could turn down the bass a little bit and turn up the treble a little bit, it would sound a little bit more like you normally do when you're talking to us by RF. But what Lou is telling us about is that when you use the classic method that was around for probably 50 or 75 years as the main method of measuring standing wave ratio, it was done on a device called a slotted line. It was really an air-type 50-ohm coaxial cable where the outer conductor had a slot along the length. And down in that slot, you would put the probe of either a voltage-sensing device or a current-sensing device. And because, by definition, when there is standing wave ratio present, you have a known amount of signal flowing forward toward the antenna. If the antenna has any imperfection, a predictable amount of signal comes back. So now, on that transmission line, which includes the slotted line, it was a forward-going wave and a reverse-going wave. Let me drop. One of the main pieces of physics that, in my opinion, is not made anywhere near as clear as it should be in all the books that you read on the subject and all the courses that you take. The thing that should be made clear is that that signal flowing forward and the signal flowing in reverse are thoroughly independent events. Those two signals do not each other. Even though the signal came from a common source, the particular transmitter or signal generator made both the forward-going signal and ultimately the reverse-going signal. And even though they're on the exact same frequency, so to speak, the forward-going signal on any transmission line and the reverse-going signal do not see each other. They fold through each other with no interaction of any kind, with one exception. And that is if the signal is so strong that you're right at the point of any kind of nonlinearity, arcing over the transmission line, overheating the center conductor. If you're at such a strong amount of signal for that particular transmission line that you're starting to get a nonlinear effect, now you will see some cross-coupling between the forward and the reverse-going signal. But under normal circumstances, you do not. Almost all transmission media behave that way. You can drop a pebble into the north side of a puddle. And watch the waves travel to the south. Drop a pebble into the south side, a pebble into the south side of the puddle, and watch the waves going to the north. Simultaneously drop a pebble in north and south side of your puddle, your puddle of water, and you'll watch those waves fold through each other with no interaction, as long as you look carefully, you know what you're looking at, up to the point where the waves are so big that they start becoming nonlinear, white caps, so to speak. Up to that point, they fold right through each other. And I, being a tower lover, can see a similar effect when I tap on a guy
repeater. Time out.
As I started saying, when I tap on a guy wire with my eye against the guy wire and I watch the pulse go up the tower, hit the tower, which is a short circuit, it reverses in polarity and comes back down. And while there's a pulse on the way back down on that guy wire, I can hit the guy wire again and make another pulse of any polarity, up, down, left, right, slant 45 degrees. And so my second pulse going up the guy wire and the one coming back down will meet in the middle, so to speak, and they fold right through each other with no interaction. So, weird phenomena. That's what happens in a one-dimensional line, a coaxial cable. You could call it a one-dimensional transmission line. The puddle is really a two-dimensional. But the transmission line, the coaxial cable, the one-dimensional transmission line, it essentially has nothing but length. You and I see some real diameter to it, but that's not a critical part of what's making it work. You can make small diameter cable, large diameter cable. In theory, they behave the exact same way, as long as you're using within their frequency region. So the forward-going signal and the reverse-going signal do not see each other. They do not mix together. They do not interact in any way. However, that voltage sensing probe you put down there, with with your slotted line into a crystal detector. It is a non-directional sensing device. It can sense the forward going wave, it can sense the reverse going wave, and inside of your probe, for the first time, you're mixing the two signals together into that crystal detector as part of your probe, and now you get an indication on your voltage sensing meter. So the probe is where the mixing takes place, not in the transmission line. As I said, many books, many people teaching standing wave ratio do not make that clear. The reason why...
Repeater, timeout.
Another reason why the forward going and the reverse going signal being thoroughly independent events, you should absorb that concept, because when you then later on study a so-called coaxial cable directional coupler or a waveguide directional coupler, and you try to figure out how it works, the independence of the two different signals going in two different directions, it helps in the understanding of how a directional coupler works. A very simple device from some point of view. They're often shown, they're often appear at flea markets at very desirable prices, and 99% of the hams will walk past that table with the directional couplers because they assume that they're useless and something they don't need and don't want and wouldn't be able to use, particularly because the frequency marking on the label might be some of the frequency region. The directional coupler may have markings on it saying it's calibrated for 500 to 1,000 megahertz. And you're a guy that operates on 6 meters and 2 meters, which is outside of the frequency region, you think that that's useless to you. But you understand how it works. For $5 or whatever that guy is selling it for, even though it originally cost maybe $1,000, it's definitely worth it. They work far outside of their frequency region, as long as you know what you're doing. And there's an article explaining that on the two separate websites, amateurradio.tangovictor, and also on Mike number one and Mike number two's website is limontechnet.com. On both of those websites, you'll find an article by K2RIW about calibrating and using directional couplers for measuring power and standing wave ratio. And that article explains how a directional coupler works far. Let me drop it. Far outside of the frequency region. So, as you can tell, there's always, to almost everybody, a lot more to be learned about standing wave ratio. And when it comes to the standing wave ratio of a dipole antenna, I thought after 35 years of experience at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, I really understood how dipoles, antennas, and impedance matching worked. And in the next 10 years, where I was doing some consulting for a particular company, where we needed some very high performance antennas, I made some further discoveries about a dipole. I mean, Mr. Hertz, so to speak, invented that dipole way back in 1860 or so. And if you, for instance, had, let me drop quick. If you had a piece of 20 ohm transmission line, and an ordinary half wave dipole has a impedance at resonance of 73 ohms as a resistor, and you want to match it to 20 ohms, the average guy would think you need all kinds of fancy doodads, balance and impedance matching transformers and toroids and whatever. All you got to do is study the Brown and Woodward curve, and you realize that as you shorten the dipole from its normal half-wave length, and you make it a known amount shorter than that distance in length, you'll eventually make the resistive component traverse from 73 ohms all the way down to 20 ohms. Very predictable. When you do that, you'll have a certain amount of capacitor reactance left over. But again, those curves will tell you exactly how much capacitor reactance. Therefore, you can put an inductor into that antenna, a known amount of microhenries or nanohenries, to get rid of the capacitive component. And now you'll have a 20 ohm resistor that'll perfectly match the cable. In other words, you can do a tremendous amount of impedance matching with a dipole by doing nothing but changing its length and feeding in the exact same way. And it works in both directions. If you want to feed it with a 600 ohm open wire line, by making the dipole longer than the half wavelength, 73 ohms will eventually go to 600 ohms, and now there'll be an amount of inductance left over that if you put a capacitor across the center, you'll get rid of the inductive reactance of the dipole, and now you've got a 600 ohm impedance matching device. The gain of the dipole doesn't change any more than a half a dB maximum when you do that. You can make a dipole match any impedance you want by doing nothing but changing the length. I have never found a book that tells you that secret. You guys now know that secret. Make sure you don't tell anybody. So, I went pretty far left of center of what you were about to tell us, Lou. We'll turn it back to you. NY2H, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW on the tech at NY2H. Okay. Yeah, I'm on a new phone here. And it's actually, I'll have to work with it a little bit, but hopefully you can at least understand me. And, I was playing with the Smith charts and doing that kind of thing. You change the length. You go around that circle around the middle of the chart, which represents a particular SWR that you might find on the antenna. And you can shift the point on the circumference to choose your resistance component. And then, as you say, you can work out you can nullify the reactive components, whether it be capacitive or inductive, series or parallel. So I went through a couple of those exercises, and that was pretty informative and instructive. And I use they call it impedance Smith chart, where they overlay the admittance chart on top of the impedance chart, so you had a lot of options as to what kind of component you wanted to add to your center point. So that was a lot of fun. So you weren't really off field. I was very interested in that, but I did want to comment and let the other fellow know that that I did take a look at that video, and that was my original comment. So that's all I have. Back to you. This is NY2H.
I think it was approximately 1938 or so when Mr. Smith, I think he was working at Bell Labs at the time, invented the so-called Smith chart. And his wife will still send one to you if you mail a copy, if you make a request to her, although he has passed away, but his wife still hands out those charts. But there are a number of websites where you can download them right now onto your printer. And the information on how to get that Smith chart is again on Mike number 2 and Mike number 1's website. And the Smith chart is a very handy way of displaying impedance of anything versus frequency. You can take a swept frequency measuring device like a network analyzer and ask it to display the information on a Smith chart or as XY chart, frequency horizontal and standing wave ratio vertical or reverse power ratio vertical, in decibels or in voltage. Modern vector network analyzers have all kinds of ways of doing it. The number of electronic engineers who have a good, warm feeling for what is a Smith chart and how to use it, they are also in the minority. I'm talking about the RF engineers, the guys who work with it day in and day out. I think less than one-third of them feel comfortable with a so-called Smith chart. Not the only way of displaying standing wave ratio, but it's the most convenient way of displaying swept standing wave ratio. And in some cases, it's more convenient to do it as an XY plot, frequency horizontal and standing wave vertical or reverse power or reverse voltage vertical, usually in decibels, but not necessarily. The point I was going to make about this one. But as I said, to make an investment to learn how to use a slotted line, which is now a pretty ancient piece of equipment, a vector network analyzer, a very modern piece of equipment, and all the kinds of way of displaying a Smith chart, 90-some-odd% of the time, a Smith chart is displayed in an impedance manner. The horizontal axis represents the resistive component. You could say the vertical axis represents the reactive component. Usually up is inductive reactance, down is capacitive reactance on a Smith chart. And so when you're adding things in series to your transmission line, resistors, capacitors, and inductors, the ordinary Smith chart is the most convenient way of explaining, of displaying that. If you're putting things in shunt, at the end of the transmission line, you're putting a capacitor from center conductor to shield, and a resistor from center conductor to shield, and an inductor. If you're doing things in shunt, it is usually more easily displayed as an admittance chart as opposed to an impedance chart. Admittance really is one over impedance. As a complex equation, if you take your impedance, which usually is a resistive component and a capacitive component, usually displayed as two separate numbers inside of a set of brackets of, what do I mean by brackets now? I can't think of the right word for the brackets, but you know what I mean. And open and close parentheses, and there's two numbers inside separated by a comma. Usually the first number is the resistor component, and the second number is the capacitor component. And that combined is a complex number. And now, if you put that as a denominator, and there's a one on top as the numerator, and now you re-rationalize that, you've now converted from a impedance number to an admittance number. And so the upside-down Smith chart is an admittance chart, which is more convenient for putting things in parallel. I would say among the people who understand a Smith chart, I'm led to believe that not more than 20% of them know how to use the admittance chart. So you got this great big group of radio people. Let me drop. You have this great group of people who do wireless work as an occupation. They do radio work day in and day out. A small percentage of them have a good warm feeling for what is standing wave ratio. A small percentage of those have a good warm feeling from us what is a Smith chart and how to use it. And a much smaller fraction of those people know how to use an admittance chart. So if you make the investment to read the right books, go to the right websites, the YouTube videos, and learn these pieces of technology, you will stand out among your fellow electronic technicians and electronic engineers and radio people. You will stand out as somebody who's got this magic piece of information that can now quantifiably do things. In other words, with those charts and with a couple of equations you throw in with them, let me drop them. You can now, if you want to, make exact predictions. If somebody tells you that the end of this 50-ohm transmission line, I decided to hang a 79-ohm resistor in series with a certain number of picofarads of capacitors, and at that operating frequency, you calculate that capacitor reactance is 91 ohms. So you got the 79 ohms of resistance and 91 ohms of capacitor reactance. There is a formula you can plug that in, not too complicated. That'll tell you exactly what standing wave ratio will result and exactly what ratio of the power going forward is going to come back. You can do that as an equation. You can do that as a plot onto a Smith chart. Smith chart will tell you there's a certain dot on that chart which represents that exact amount of resistance and that exact amount of capacitive reactance, and you can swing a circle around from the center of the chart using that dot as the place where you put the pencil, and now you know the standing wave ratio at closely aligned frequencies, and you've got a graphic representation of that standing wave ratio. That chart will also tell you what to do if you want to get to the center of the chart where the standing wave ratio is 1-to-1, where the reflected power ratio goes to zero. So, as I said, making an investment to learn these things, in my opinion, is valuable. You don't have to do it. Let me drop. There's many a very effective ham radio operator who never really gets a warm feeling for what's going on. By way of his buddies giving him instruction, he comes up with a bunch of rules of thumb that if my antenna behaves this way, I do this to it, and usually it gets better. Or I start experimenting with making the dipole a little longer, a little bit shorter, and re-measuring the standing wave ratio to see if I'm going in the right direction. And then plotting that so-called bathtub-shaped curve where when you got things set just right, the bottom of the bathtub is your favorite operating frequency where your antenna gives the lowest possible standing wave ratio, and at the two ends of the bands, it goes to a higher standing wave ratio. Hopefully it's an amount that can be tolerated by your antenna tuner. And what does an antenna tuner do? And can you plot that on the Smith chart? Absolutely. And does the antenna tuner waste all the power that gets reflected back to it? Absolutely not. It re-reflects it forward. And you say those words on 20 meters on a Saturday afternoon, there's a whole lot of people who'll say, no, you're crazy. I know that I don't want to use an antenna tuner because it takes all that reverse power and just throws it away. There's a lot of people who believe that crazy theory, which is not true. Okay, thank you for bringing up the subject, John. Back to you for any other comments. And I hope the rain didn't hit you in your backyard. I just came back from New York City, and boy, was it raining. KC2SHO, K2RIW, you got it, John.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Yeah, enjoying the conversation as always. But I guess I'm still not clear. Have you watched the video? Did you have any comments on it? Was there anything that, I don't imagine it brought too much new into your world, but I was curious if you had any comments on that. I just thought it was such a good video that it was very instructional, where actually some other videos I think might actually lead you astray, where this one seems to really nail down a lot of the important points that need to be made. Anyway, so just curious if you watched it and if you had any comments, and I guess that's all I really had. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
I'm going to have to admit, though, John, I haven't seen it yet. You did mention to us that it's approximately 1 hour, or a little bit more, or a little bit less. And I did mention that I'm a little worried that some people will not start watching it because they know that they don't have a full hour of free time, that they're going to get interrupted somewhere in the middle. So, no, I haven't seen it yet, but I intend to. So hopefully by next week I'll tell you what I thought. Some of the really good YouTube videos are the ones that are called Veritasium. V-E-R-I-T-A-S-U-M, I think it is. Derek Mueller, a scientist from, was a very young scientist from Australia. He looks to me like he's about 30 years old, but boy, is he smart. He's made about 30 real good YouTube videos on various subjects about science, electronics, physics, and so on. Most of his are physics. And each one of them is, I'm going to make a guess, around 7 or 8 minutes long. So they're a very nicely packaged YouTube video. Of the class of the MIT professor, all of a sudden I can't think of his name right now.
Lewin.
Yeah, Walter Lewin. Walter Lewin of MIT has a series of YouTube videos that are very good. Unfortunately, they're a little bit long, most of them. Whereas the Veritasium videos, almost all of them are in the 8 minute category.
Dementic?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
KC2WGV. Dick, maybe you want to give that standing wave URL for those who weren't present with us last week.
Okay, would you like to say it right now? Go right ahead, John.
I don't have it handy with me. I thought you'd had it, but maybe John can give it to us.
Well, unfortunately, I am sitting outside on my patio, and again, I have some guests here, so... not in front of the computer at the moment, but it's pretty easy to find. If you type standing up for standing waves into YouTube search bar, or even into Google, you'll find a whole bunch about it. But if you really want to find the hour-long video, I think the best thing to do is to look for that, I think it was Ham Radio Now, episode 199, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, if you type in Ham Radio Now, standing up for standing waves, I'm sure you'll find it quite quickly. But that's the one way to find the whole video. Otherwise, you might only find some quick pieces or snippets of that video. And I believe the gentleman who turned me onto this video is listening via web tonight. I was hoping he would make it over here and we would listen tonight together. But he was unable to do that, and that would be... KC3BVL, so just want to say hello to him. I'm listening out there on the web feed. K2RIW, KC2SH.
I've been looking back in my notes, John, and it was on May 17th, 2 weeks ago, that you brought that number 99 video to our attention. So you had to remember that last week. Weeks go by so fast. Charlie Mike Quebec. What would you like to discuss tonight, Neil? K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yes, Dick. I'm considering taking on a project that, if my basic premise is incorrect, I would spend a heck of a lot of time banging my head on the wall. So I wanted to run it by and see if anybody had any ideas. Basically, if you take any antenna, say the antenna you've talked about a number of times, or your friend hung a piece of wire in a tree on, and then on the other side used a ground stake. I went through all the charts and everything and built three different circuits to tune it to three different frequencies, for argument's sake, say one for 80, one for 40, and one for 20. And then I wired them in parallel at the base of the antenna. Would the same principles apply as, say, a fan dipole where the signal is going to follow? Sorry, I dropped there. Where it would follow, say, the least of fast of least impedance and create a rudimentary automatic transmission, automatic antenna tuner? Or would I just end up with a mess? Thanks.
The very simple answer to your question, Neil, is you'll end up with a mess. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm saying if you just take the simple, direct approach, it will not work. And I'm going to explain why. When you feed a dipole in the center, in the conventional manner, and you've made a fan dipole system, you got one that's 132 feet long, that's 80 meters, and you've got one that's 67 feet long, and that's 40 meters, and so on. You got an 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meter dipole. Five separate dipoles all connected together to a common point. That fan dipole has this automatic switching characteristic, which I'll explain. That 80 meter dipole, when you feed a signal into it at 80 meters, presents something close to a 72 ohm resistive impedance. The 40 meter dipole at that time is going to present something like 1500 ohms of inductive reactance. The 20 meter antenna is going to do something similar. In other words, each of the other antennas are going to be so close to an open circuit that less than 1% of the power will flow down them when simultaneously there is the 80 meter dipole there presenting a 73 ohm resistor. So you've got a 73 ohm resistor, which is the 80 meter dipole. You've got all these other dipoles in parallel, but they are representing close to an open circuit. Therefore, essentially none of the power flows into it. So a center-fed dipole is a kind of automatic switching network. The power goes down the right dipole at the right time and ignores all the others. When fed in the center, and center feeding, it's got some advantages and some disadvantages. The main advantage is the most classic way of feeding a dipole. Everybody does it that way, and they think there's no other way of doing it. If you're smart enough to use the right kind of a balancing device, then you don't have to feed the dipole in the center. You can feed the dipole center, 10% off of center, 50% off of center, 90% off center, at the outer end of the dipole. You can feed the dipole anywhere you want. And if you're smart enough in the way you do it, it'll give you close to 100% efficiency, and it'll work like a charm. There's nothing magic about the center. It's just the tradition. 99.9% of the guys think that's the only way to do it. When you feed the outer end of the dipole, and as you move away from the center, the impedance that you see stays resistive, but goes higher and higher. And by the time you get to the outer end of the dipole and you decide to feed it there, you're feeding something like a 1,500 ohm resistor. Believe it or not, it's not a reactor. It's a pure 1,500 ohm, 2,000 ohm resistor. If you try to match that to a 50 ohm coaxial cable, you're getting a 50 to 1 standing wave ratio. A direct connection is going to work rather poorly. However, one simple inductor and capacitor, as in L network, will automatically step up your impedance from your 50 ohm cable to the 1500 ohm or 2000 ohm impedance of the outer end of your dipole that you're deciding to feed. And there's a huge advantage of doing that. Let me drop. And first of all, how do you select that right inductor and right capacitor? Well, you can look at the appropriate chapter in the beginning of the Radio Amateur's Handbook. It'll give you a hint. It's not going to give you the exact answer. But if you go to the Berkeley program, if you simply Google the word Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, plus impedance match, and you'll find the Berkeley program. And the Berkeley program will ask you, what is the impedance of your load? In other words, the resistive component, the reactive component. In your case, it's going to be, we'll say, 1,500 ohms and no reactants. It asks you, what's the impedance of your source? That's going to be your 50-ohm transmitter. And what's the frequency of operation? And you'll type in 80 meters. And you press go. And Berkeley will give you 16 separate solutions. Or is it 12? But it's a large number of solutions. An L network, a T network, an inverse L network, a pi network, a T pi network, and so on. 16 separate solutions with all the values. Choose the one that you like. And so by way of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, if the inductor required is, let me pick a number, 5 microhenries, and by way of the equation and the curves that are in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, you'll know pretty fast if you're going to hand wind that air wound inductor on a piece of PVC tubing. Once you know the diameter of your tubing, which is really the diameter of your solenoid coil, and make a rough guess as to how close you're going to space the turns, you plug in those numbers to an equation, it'll tell you exactly how many microhenries you're going to get. So to hand wind that inductor, if you choose to do that, it's pretty easy. And it contains less than $1 worth of materials. And then when it comes to the capacitor for the L network, you can make a homebrew capacitor if you want to. There's an equation that'll tell you how to do that. You can homebrew that capacitor by just putting two plates close together, with or without a piece of dielectric material in between. A very handy formula is 0.225 A over T. In other words, you take 0.225, a constant, multiply it by A over T. A is the area in square inches. T is the spacing, the thickness, so to speak, of the spacing between the two plates of a two-plate capacitor, and that simple formula will tell you with 5% error or less exactly how many picofarads. That formula gives picofarads of an air-insulated capacitor, 0.225 A over T. Area is the A, T is the spacing between the two plates. And now if you put a piece of plastic in between, you know that your piece of plexiglass has got a dielectric constant of 3, we'll say, because you looked it up, then the amount of capacitance you just calculated just got multiplied by 3. That's what dielectric constant of 3 means. You put it between two plates, and whatever capacitance you had with air, you now fill it up with that plastic with a dielectric constant of 3, and you're going to get 3 times the number of picofarads. So to make the capacitor by hand, to make the inductor by hand, to make that L network that matches your 50-ohm transmission line up to 1,500 or 2,000 ohms in my example, because you're feeding the bottom of a vertical half-wave long dipole.
Repeater, timeout.
Because that impedance is so high, that's the one kind of ground plane antenna where you do not need 32 ground plane radials to get 100% efficiency. The 32 ground plane radials are when radiator is a quarter wavelength long, which is half of your center fed dipole. Your center fed dipole is 72 ohms. Half of that is 36 ohms. A quarter wave dipole in front of, on top of a ground plane, is a 36 ohm resistor. In order to make your ground plane have something very small compared to 36 ohms, you would like it to have less than 3.6 ohms, or maybe 0.36 ohms. And that takes them a whole lot of ground plane radials to do that. Stand by a second. But in this particular case, you're feeding a 1,500 100 ohm impedance. Therefore, your ground plane, to be high in efficiency, only has to be 150 ohms of resistance to the rest of the earth, so to speak. A simple stake in the ground will do that for you. You're going to get 95% efficiency with just a stake in the ground for the ground plane radial system. You see the advantage of that. The good news is that you can now feed the outer end of a half-wave dipole. Let me drop. And now you've got a perfect impedance match, an extremely simple antenna, particularly for portable operations. You, with your bow and arrow or with your slingshot, you put this wire up in the tree, the bottom end of it. It doesn't have to be purely vertical, by the way. It's really an end-fed ZEP antenna. ZEP means a Zeppelin, because this kind of an antenna was first used on blimps way back in the dark ages. Now, that impedance matching network, that inductor and capacitor, that L network, into that dipole, presents a 50 ohm load at that resonant frequency. And now you would think, similar to a fan dipole, you can now set up a whole bunch of these individual half-wave vertical pieces of wire, one for 80 meters, one for 40 meters, and one for 20 meters, and a separate L network on each one. It's not the same L network because each one's operating on a different frequency. That L network has a certain amount of inductive reactance of that inductor and capacitor reactance of that capacitor that gives you a perfect impedance match at that frequency. But you feed that L network at some other frequency, and its impedance is going to be something very wild. So in this particular case, you'd like to believe you can set up a three of these end-fed dipoles with three of these L networks and bring them all together as a common point. And the answer is essentially no. They're going to interact with each other. A very simple switching network, a single pole, three pole switch, would switch in the right L network to the right dipole, and it would work. And all these dipoles, by the way, could be side by side. They'll have very little interaction with each other. So by way of a clip lead, by which you you do the switching yourself manually, or a remotely operated, very simple relay. By the way, when you're operating at frequencies as low as 80, 40, and 20 meters, you would think only a coaxial cable, a coaxial relay would work. All the way up to 50 megacycles, I've used a small, high-power crystal can relay, one that's made for 5 amperes of current. And this crystal can relay was probably inch and a half high, inch square, and it was made for a 5 ampere DC circuit. I used it as a transmit-receive relay on my 300-watt, 6-meter transmitter. Worked like a charm, as long as you keep the leads real short and do some extra shielding, so to speak. The crystal can relay was a metal can, so it naturally was shielded. It wasn't a coaxial structure, but as long as you keep the lead short enough, the amount of stray inductance is small, calculatable, it can be compensated. So for you to make a switching network, to switch in the right L network into the right end-fed dipole would work like a charm. But in this particular case, putting them in parallel, they will interact with each other. Let me drop. Now, if you're real smart, there's ways of adding an extra LC network to each one of these such that they become an open circuit electronically, automatically, when you're on the wrong frequency. I'm making a slightly more elaborate L network on each one. You could make the switching automatic. I didn't say that's easy. I mean, to do the calculations to make them not interact with each other is something doable. It's just not quite as easy as it would be with a fan dipole. And so in this particular case, the easiest solution would be a switching network, whether it be you moving a clip lead on the end of the coax cable, so to speak, or having a real remotely controlled relay. So know that it's possible to do what you want to do, just that at first it's not going to work. One of the universal laws that I've often ran into was you build something brand new for the first time. almost all real good ideas, new ideas, do not work at first. Mother Nature is like that. Murphy's Law, you could call it. So all good, brand new ideas almost do not work at first. You have to stick in there and do divide and conquer and find out why it's not working. Get down to the individual components that are not working and make them work, if you know what I mean. So this can be made to work. You've got a good idea. But to just do it as a simple throw it together like you would with a fan dipole, unfortunately, I think the answer at first is no, Neil. KD2CMQ. And by the way, don't let me discourage you. I know it's doable. I wouldn't dare say it's impossible, because you're the kind of guy to go out there and do it. KD2CMQ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. Only talk. Although that is. It's an idea I have.
Yes, Dick, that's correct. He had the bobbin that could wind,
and he made the cores out of simple things like straws and some tubing that he had picked up at Home Depot. Some of it was nylon, some looked like Teflon. It wasn't very thick, but when you cut it short, it was rigid enough to hold these cores. And he used little paper washers on the ends just to hold the coils in line. And yes, they were multi-layer. Some of them were like 500 turns in a width of about maybe 3/8 of an inch or half an inch, somewhere around there. And multi-layer. And yes, he used Krylon to paint them, and that fixed them. And they worked out very well. And he had some nice time. He had a little, he was using a comparator bridge and a sample L network so that he knew the impedance of the sample device, and he would compare it, would give the ratio so he could tell, you know, how many Henrys and what the inductive values were, things like that. Just very clever stuff, and his age is, I think he's just going to be 17, so that's some good work from a young adult.
I wonder, John, did you measure the actual inductance? You probably have a Q meter, or you can do it with your vector network analyzer. You could actually measure the inductance and compare it to the calculation for the number of turns. It would be also interesting to find out what is the self-resonant frequency. And there's a lot of different things you can measure about a coil. Every coil with multiple turns, you've got some capacitance between those turns, between the layers, therefore at some particular frequency, with no capacitor across the coil at all, other than its straight capacitance between its turns, it will hit resonance. So when you plot its apparent inductive reactance versus frequency on a network analyzer, you'll find that at some particular frequency, the network, the inductance, the apparent inductance, or the inductive reactance, suddenly jumps up to a very high number when you hit that self-resonant frequency, the parallel self-resonant frequency. And it might even be an even higher frequency where it goes into series self-inductance resonance. I doubt it, but there is that possibility. And where somebody winds a coil, let me drop. Where they wanted to carry cover a very large number of frequencies, they sometimes wind that multi-turn coil on a conic-shaped coil form, a cone-shaped coil form, in which case, if it's done correctly, it can cover a very large number of octaves with an inductor that will stay as a pure inductor across that whole frequency region. People who use an inductor injector for a coaxial cable, in other words, the coaxial cable going up the tower can be used for transmitting radio signals going up and down, and you can also put positive voltage, negative voltage, AC voltage, and whatever on the center conductor as a way of communicating or powering things that are on top of the tower. And the inductor that you use to do that, a conically wound inductor, would do it. So a further experiment which we did measure the inductance, measure the self-resonant frequency. You've got the equipment that can do that, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, I do, Dick. They had a lot of fun. What they were basically trying to learn is when they put a waveform on one coil, they were working basically with 60 cycles, and putting different ferrite bead rods through the center to see the magnetic coupling between them, proximity of the coils, what difference it made. They also rotated them to look at phases. They were having a lot of fun that way. And they haven't done any frequency experiments yet. Maybe they'll do that next week when they come by. But just the idea of taking that sewing machine, he can wind up to number 18 gauge wire without a problem. He believes he can do 16, but he has trouble getting 16 solid. So that's what he's trying to get now. But he made some very nice coils. Right, let me let it drop on one to my next question. Okay, now I'll give you an idea of this construct, and then maybe you can help this gentleman. Right now, he has a nice piece of property. He's got a 20 and a 40 meter dipole horizontal. The 20 meter is mounted above the 40. Its pattern is north to south.